Valdemar Velasquez from the Farm Labor Organizing Committee.
Real hero. I don't know about that. I think one of the things we have to accept, we spent the day together here. I think we can consider ourselves family here, so I want to talk some historical trajectory in terms of our discussion here today and where we're going. You know, we're a small union. We represent a little over 13,000 farm workers, migrant workers in Ohio, Michigan, North Carolina, and Virginia. We have contracts with some of the world's largest food companies, Campbell Soup, Heinz, Dean Foods, Vlasic Pickle, now Manawa Pickle Company in North Carolina. And the setting in which we organize is probably the worst remnants of economic exploitation, oppression in America. And it's historical. What's happening today was happening 100 years ago, 200 years ago. This trade agreements is nothing new. What NAFTA represents, it's an economic phenomenon that's been going on for a very, very long time. I mean, I think of the first NAFTA agreement that I was intimately familiar with was the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, when the United States took all of the Southwest from Mexico. And you all remember that story about the Alamo, right? That wasn't a fight for liberty and freedom as the way the movies make it out to be. That was a fight for white superiority. You remember in those days in the early 1800s, there was this expansionist period westward during the James Polk administration. You know, they found a very polite way to cover this imperialism. They called it manifest destiny. Well, I don't read in the Bible anywhere where anybody had the right to rape, pillage, and plunder somebody else's land. But there was expansion westward, and you remember what the contest was in the early 1800s in this country. There was the slave South and the industrial North. And as the expansion was going westward, they were running a race to see which territories would be claimed as free territories and slave territories. And Texas was being led by this guy named Stephen Austin, who founded the Republic of Texas. Well, go to your history books, your students here, and you see and read the Constitution for the Republic of Texas, that it was to be a slave republic. And that's what these guys were fighting at the Alamo, because Mexico at that time was either adopting or just passed a law banning slavery in all the Mexican territories of which Texas was a part of. And so, and then you got these supposed heroes like Jim Bowie, you know, the guy with the cuchillo. Well, he sold his 97 slaves in Louisiana and took that money and bought a large tract of land in the Republic of Texas, because he knew the policy of cheap labor and cheap land, you know, land, labor, and capital, would reap him a handsome reward. And that's why he was fighting at the Alamo. So, I mean, this economic trajectory has been going on for years and years and years in this country. And the current NAFTA agreement is just, it's a legal manifestation of this economic phenomenon. I mean, what they did with NAFTA, they were already doing before the NAFTA agreement was signed with the maquiladoras on the border. So what's new? So it is no surprise to me. When I was raised, I was born in South Texas, right on the border there, 8 miles this side of the river, for better or for worse. That's where I was born. And those sugar beet companies from Ohio and Michigan were down there recruiting all the Mexican laborers in the Rio Grande Valley to come north to do the cheap labor, seasonal crops in Ohio and Michigan. That's why my family got stranded up there. And so I was raised in those labor shanties and barns and chicken coops the farmers put us in. Now, these are the small family farmers I was talking about this afternoon. I like to joke about that Willie Nelson sings for these guys. These are the small family farmers that these guys represent. And but you know what? Even though a lot of those farmers took advantage of us, they stole our money, they treated us bad, they were not the people who were the economic determinators of the economic relationship. Because you had these giant food companies like Campbell Soup who dictated all the prices on down, supposedly forces of the market, right? Well, as if we're not part of the market, labor's not part of the market. What about his labor and my labor? Don't that count for something? Only thing that counts at the market are their profit margins. Well, we have to figure out a way to make our side of the market count. And so we designed a campaign to say, no, we have to look at this different. In terms of union organizing, you know, unions, we have to start thinking, and I include myself in this bunch. I'm, you know, aiming a cannon at myself, so to speak. I'm part of the AFL-CIO, part of the labor movement. But we need to relook at the way we organize our unions. We have to forget about that we're trying to maintain and organize a quote institution called the union, because we forget why unions were founded in the first place and their mission and their purpose. Their purpose is to look out for each other, a collective benefit of all of us working together to watching out for one. That's why some of them are called brotherhoods originally. They're looking out for each other the way these guys are hammering us from the top down. But we have to be smart about the way we fight them back. Now, what we're talking about here, we're going in the face of history. We're fighting in the face of this engine that's just driving the world to accumulate centers of money all over the world. They call them, you know, the markets. You know, like you got the our hemisphere here, and then you got the Asian countries, and then you got the European community. And they're out there hammering each other to capture this part of the market and that part, and we're the pawns. And so we have to look at the pockets of money that immediately exploit us, that are tied into the broader money centers of the world. And actually, we have to be thinking in terms of organizing money and redistributing money, as opposed to organizing this institution called the union and that institution called the union, or whatever we call our pitiful little organizations, which we are. But we got to use our pitiful little organizations wisely and smartly to try to defend as many people as we possibly can. So what we did in our little contribution in Ohio, we went past the employer, which was the farmer, and went directly to the corporation that dictated prices in the entire industry. We went to the heart of Campbell Soup. And we forced them in an 8-year strike, an 8-year boycott campaign, some of you participated in that, to sign the first multi-party collective bargaining agreement in labor history. This gave us a leverage to raise prices for the farmers and compel it to come out of Campbell's Soup pocket, not out of the farmer's pocket, because after all, these are the work sites where we come to work, and we have to preserve those work sites. So we had to defend the farmer when the farmer couldn't defend himself, so we had to fight our fight and the farmer's fight so that we could continue to work and increase our benefits and our wages so that we could feed our families. And everybody thought we were nuts, but we convinced enough people that that was the case. And you don't have to organize everybody in the world, just enough people to make a difference. And the formula there was, I told a story this afternoon that I learned this lesson from Martin Luther King Jr. at a meeting we had in Atlanta when we were planning the Poor People's Campaign back in 1968, the winter of 1968. And Martin Luther King Jr. said about fighting enormous opponents, powerful, money, in which we had nothing, we're poor people. He said, if you impede the rich man's ability to make money, anything is negotiable, including this precedent-setting multi-party collective bargaining agreement, which we weren't even employees of the company, but they sat down and negotiated with us anyway. So, and then to maintain that three-party relationship, we created a commission, which was the equivalent of a national labor board by private agreement, and had Campbell sign on to the authority to come under the authority of that commission because the commission had authority to issue fines, penalties, and make whole remedies if they violated the contents of collective bargaining. And now we had that commission. Every employer that we took on from then on, before we asked them for union recognition, we asked them to recognize the authority of that commission. So we went right down the road. After we got Campbell, we got Heinz, we got Anchain Pickle, we got Green Bay Foods, we got Dean's Corporation, we got Vlasic. In 3 short years, we unionized the entire tomato and cucumber industry in northern Ohio and southeast Michigan. And then we moved the campaign to North Carolina with the Mount Olive Pickle Company, the big competitor of the Vlasic Pickle Company. And we extended that commission to North Carolina and added 2 commissioners from North Carolina so they could do the mediating and the arbitrating and our grievance procedures. And the 5-year campaign with Mount Olive, we got them too, but we got the North Carolina Growers Association. And there, with the Growers Association, we're talking here 800 employers, 8,000 workers on 800 farms in North Carolina. Most of them tobacco farmers, they weren't even cucumber farmers. But we targeted the Mount Olive Pickle Company because they had an overlap tie with the North Carolina Grower Association. Their growers are members of that association, and jointly they recruited these guest workers from Mexico to come work in these. This is the guest worker program that Bush is pushing for right now. He wants to expand it and make it this big guest worker program. Well, people that ask me, when Flock signed this agreement with Mount Olive and North Carolina Grower Association, it's the largest guest worker program in the United States. And we unionized that guest worker program. And people ask me, well, does that mean that Flock is for these guest worker programs that Bush is talking about? I said, no. We are opposed to those programs. We are for workers' rights, that they have a right to defend themselves. I don't care what condition they come up here. If they come up here as guest workers, unionize them. If they come up here as undocumented workers, unionize them. You know, the first labor leaders organized the first unions in this country. They didn't ask what country you came from. They said, which side are you on? You know, that famous song written about that? Well, that's what we're supposed to do. So unions ought to get the heck out of debating this issue and get to work and organizing those undocumented workers and defending them. Because if you get that rich person to the negotiating table, because he's hurting financially, anything is negotiable, and you can, whatever system you're using to exploit undocumented workers, use the same system to defend them and represent them and defend their rights. And so, but now we extend this agreement into Mexico because the visas are issued in Monterrey, the American consulate. So we opened an office in Monterrey, Mexico to oversee the seniority recruitment. This year alone, we've saved about 700 workers their jobs that would have been blacklisted by those growers in North Carolina, or the association, not the growers. Because they want to have full control over those workers' lives, but now the workers got a grievance procedure and they're filing grievances in Mexico. And so now we're organizing committees throughout Mexico, those H-2A workers, to begin to defend their own communities. Because the role of unions is to defend one another in our communities. A union is not just collective bargaining in the workplace and filing grievances and blah, blah, blah. I mean, we got to go beyond the workplace, go into the community. When you organize in North Carolina, I'll tell you how to organize that Smithfield operation down there. First, we make a permanent commitment to the community. And the turnover in the South is so large that you may be agriculture today, you'll be in poultry tomorrow. Next day, you're in construction. Next day, you're back in that community. It's a very fluid labor force. So we organize in the community in general and create a base of workers. That's our leadership group. And then as we indicate where they're working, we go after those work sites to get on those employers. But we always have that base. We make a permanent commitment to the community. We're here to defend the rights of our brothers and sisters, whether you get a contract or not. The collective bargaining agreement is a result of doing the right and good thing long enough, and the workers will respond and they'll join and they'll be part of this organizing community, this militant community defending their rights. Have we got workers deported because they get involved in campaigns? Yeah, they get deported, but we get them back anyway. I mean, that's one of our slogans is aquí estamos y no nos vamos y si nos echan nos regresamos. That's the bottom line, you know. We snuck over here in the first one, we can sneak over again. And they want to build that wall in Mexico and make fun of it. Remember that song we learned in grade school? Rock my soul in the bosom of Abraham. Rock my soul in the bosom of Abraham. Remember that song? And they say they're going to build a wall to keep out the Mexicans. Build a wall to keep out the Mexicans. Build a wall to keep out the Mexicans. Oh, rock my soul. It won't be so high that we can't get over it. It won't be so low that we can't get under it. It won't be so wide that we can't get around it. Oh, rock my soul. So, see, here's the thing. The final thing. Let me end with this, because this is a signal you send to employers, rich people, anytime you start a campaign. And now this is hard, because it lands in right at the heart of why we lose so many battles and why we don't have the stamina to stay out a battle long enough until we win. A lot of us give up because we have a lot to lose. Labor unions today are losing left and right because they don't want to put everything on the line. I attended a rally in Cincinnati. Kroger store replaced 120 truck drivers, Teamster truck drivers, for a non-union trucking company out of Texas. So we supported a rally they had at the Kroger National Headquarters in Cincinnati. And I gave my solidarity speech and told them that, look, if the Teamsters wanted, the UFCW represents all those clerks and workers in the store at Kroger. The Teamsters represent drivers of the other lines that deliver those groceries at Kroger. Other unions represent other sectors in that same operation. If all those unions said, you know what, we're going to put everything in this to save those 120 truck driving jobs, they could have had it over just like that. We could have saved the Patco air controllers if we had a general strike of all workers in this country and shut down the country. We could have, but we didn't. You know why? Because we had too much to lose. Well, I can't do that. It's against my contract. I might lose my pension. I might lose my this and that. Well, solidarity's got to cost something. Solidarity means you got to sacrifice something. So if you're an organizer and you want the workers to believe and to follow you, then you got to put everything on the line. You got to be the example, because that's what you're asking those workers to do. You never ask a worker to do something that you wouldn't do yourself first. Now here I am, I'm 59 years old, right? You think, but somebody asked me, well, Balamar, shouldn't you be thinking about when you get older and, you know, what are you going to do when you can't do this anymore? You know, what about a pension? Well, I don't have a pension and I ain't looking for one. Only thing I got to my name is my D18 Martin guitar and a 1986 Dodge Stratus with 236,000 miles on it. And am I looking for anything else? No, what I have, I give away, give it to the organization, go organize. Because you don't have nothing, you don't have nothing to lose. So I can fight forever. And they ain't gonna take nothing away from me because I ain't got nothing to give them. But it reminds me, like I said, when I met Cesar Chavez and Martin Luther King Jr. within a 6-month period of the same year, that 1968. And both men, one thing that they had in common when you met them, and that is that you were convinced beyond a doubt when you met them that they were completely sold out to the cause that they were fighting for, regardless of the cost of themselves. They gave the ultimate solidarity. And because a person can give his life, it makes giving up everything else a lot easier. And people ask me, well, but what drives you to this point? And I don't know about you all, I don't mean any disrespect to anybody, but I'm a Christian. And it says in Scripture in Matthew 6, verse 26, it says, don't worry about tomorrow. Only worry about today. I said, look at the birds of the air. This is Jesus talking. He says, look at the birds of the air. They no sow nor reap, nor store up grains in barns. Yet my heavenly Father cares for them. How much more am I going to care for you? And if you're going to be worrying about what you're going to wear tomorrow, why worry about that? Look at the lilies of the field. Not even Solomon in all his splendor is dressed as one of these. How much more am I going to dress you? So don't worry about tomorrow. See, I stand on that word. And you know what? I've been involved in this struggle for 39 years, and I've never had to worry about a meal. I've never had to worry about where I'm coming and going. I got a lot of friends, and I don't have a problem. But the person who gets the message is the opposition. It's not that I'm trying to be, you know, fancy or, you know, brag about anything, but the opposition knows that. They know that you're going to give everything. You know that you're going to go down to the end. And when they get that message, they know it's not going to get any better for them. It's only going to get worse for them. So you go after their money. You impede their ability to make money, and you're going to keep at it. And then you're not going to give up. You're going to give everything you got. You're going to put everything on the line, including what you've gained up to now. The workers will follow you. Not only the workers will follow you, but the opposition is going to know that if they don't want things to get worse, they better settle with you. And basically, every company we've negotiated with, that's in the bottom line. They said, we just saw that it wasn't going to get any better. It was just getting worse. And they had to do things that they otherwise would have never even thought of doing, even under the collective bargaining law. So ignore the politicians, ignore the laws, and go empower the workers. Go for the money, go for the jugular, and compel them to do things that they otherwise wouldn't do. And you got to extend this anywhere the structure is of those corporations are. If it goes into another country, go there too. Those workers are your brothers and sisters. They're not Mexicans and we're Americans and these guys are Canadians over there and these guys are Indians and Sri Lankans. You know, we're all working, harvesting, cutting those cucumbers, cutting those tobacco leaves. We're doing the hard back-breaking work that people don't want to do. We're down there on the bottom doing it. They're our brothers and sisters. They bleed like us. They cry like us. Their tears are salty like us. They're the same. And we can get that idea across to everybody, and we have true global unions and true collective international agreements with these same companies. That's where we need to go. And the heck with, they can set all the rules they want because we'll break the rules. They told us that we couldn't negotiate with Campbell Soup because, you know, unions are between employer and employees. And next thing they can do, they want to pass a law to keep us arguing with the farmer. Ain't going to do no good to argue with this guy. He don't got no money to give us. Got to go find the people who give him the money and get that money to both of us so that we can both live better lives. So come on, folks. It's doable and we can do it. And I want to sit here and encourage you and let you know that if the farm workers in North Carolina, the least unionized state in the country, can sign one of the largest collective bargaining agreements in labor history in the state of North Carolina where there's no support, anti-union, right-to-work laws, if the farm workers can do it, the poultry processing workers can do it, everybody else can do it, and you all can do it too, because it's the same money that circulates the world.